Well, our passage this morning was a pretty well-known one, but its fame pales into insignificance alongside the fame that this evening's passage enjoys. You really will struggle, I think, to find a more iconic Old Testament narrative than this one. David and Goliath, I suppose, may just about be on a par. Jonah and the big fish may only be a little way behind, but Daniel and the lion's den truly is a classic tale. And this evening I want us to look at it together under three headings. And notice with me, first of all then, the king's swagger. The king's swagger. Now, on several occasions over the last 2 years, there have been images in the news of Donald Trump sitting at his desk, putting his signature to some piece of new legislation. In some instances, the legislation he's signing is a direct undoing of something that his predecessor initiated. But whether that anti-Obama dimension is present or not, these occasions are usually rather triumphalistic, aren't they? Trump there kind of scrawling his signature in large letters and then holding up the document in front of the flashing cameras, his people standing behind him with beaming faces. The whole scene oozes smugness. It's with a swagger that Trump ratifies this or that new law. And it's with a similar swagger, I would put it to you, that King Darius, in verse 9 of our passage, puts his signature to a new law. Had there been photographers present there, they would have snapped images of the king looking very pleased with himself. Why? Why this swagger, as Darius puts pen to paper here? Well, I want to suggest to you two reasons. And in each case, the narrator wants us to see an element, a significant element of irony. So first of all, then, there's a swagger in Darius because of the content of this law. There's a swagger in Darius because of the content of this law. What is the content? Well, you all know it. It's there in verse 7. The presidents, the prefects, the satraps, they have agreed, second half of the verse, that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, there's some debate as to what status exactly was being conferred on Darius by this law. Some say that the law can't be conferring on him full divine status, because unlike some other ancient civilizations, Persians didn't worship their emperors. And so rather this is conferring on him some kind of mediatorial role, if you like. He is the only one through whom prayer may be offered to the gods. And that may or it may not be true, but I think that we can safely say that if this law didn't actually deify Darius, then it virtually deified him. That was pretty much the significance of it. It certainly went a long way down that line of saying Darius is himself a divine being. And doubtless Darius found that appealing, being regarded as pretty much a god. And that's probably why then, without apparently giving the matter any real thought or asking any questions, he just immediately there in verse 9 gets out his pen and inscribes his signature on the document. He's kind of intoxicated with this thought of being that honoured and that revered by his subjects, put on a divine pedestal. And so, as I say then, relishing this prospect of being deified throughout his kingdom, he signs this law with a swagger. Now, I mentioned a moment ago irony. So where is the irony here? Well, it's this. Here is this great king, but he wants more than just being a great king. His officials tempt him with this prospect of being a kind of god, and he grasps at it. He enthusiastically signs this document in front of him. And what happens? Well, the man who wanted to become more than a great king actually becomes less than a great king. I mean, look at verse 14. And this is after Daniel has been convicted of praying to his God during this 30-day period. And we read, "Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. And he labored till the sun went down to rescue him." Does he succeed? No. He can't now, this great king, the Persian emperor, he can't now even spare a man in his kingdom whom he wants to spare. The Persian emperor here is humiliatingly helpless to do anything about this man whom he wants to spare from the lion's den. The great king who wanted to become more has actually become less. He's become a pitiful figure, trapped within this legislation. Is it not in its own way a little echo of the seminal Bible story, the story of the Garden of Eden? Adam was a great king, wasn't he? Ruling over God's creation. But he wanted more. And the serpent tempted him with the prospect of being what? Being like God. And he grasped it. And he chomped his jaws on that forbidden fruit. And what happened? Well, the man who wanted to become more than a great king became less. And the creation slipped from his control and became this resistant, unruly domain full of thorns and thistles. Doesn't it make you thankful that we know of one king who was different? King Jesus. Remember how he, in the desert at the start of his public ministry, was tempted by the devil, similarly, to be dissatisfied. To be dissatisfied with his human limitations, to want more, command these stones to become loaves of bread. In other words, don't act as a dependent human being. Break out of those stifling restraints. Use supernatural power to produce food for yourself, Jesus. But King Jesus resisted the temptation. He didn't grasp after being more. And he didn't therefore become less. He didn't join Adam and Darius in the scrapyard of failed kings whose egos got the better of them. Thank God for King Jesus. So there's a swagger in Darius because of the content of this law. But then secondly, there's a swagger in Darius because of the status of this law. What is its status? Well, it's unchangeable. That's emphasized again and again, isn't it? And doubtless that also appealed to his ego as he signed that document. The fact that no one was going to be able to come along tomorrow and undo this law that he was ratifying. It was a law of the Medes and Persians. And what's the irony here? Well, the irony here is just this, that by the end of the chapter, the law has in fact been completely scrapped, hasn't it? This unchangeable law that nobody could possibly alter, it's been completely scrapped. The law insisting that no prayer can be made except either to or through at least King Darius, it's been replaced with that decree of verse 26, that in all my royal dominion people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. So much for the unchangeable law he passed. It reminds us, doesn't it, that there's actually only one sovereign whose decisions and decrees are truly sacrosanct and unalterable. And that sovereign is not Darius, it's Yahweh. We read about that, didn't we, at the start of our service tonight in Isaiah 46. I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me. My counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish all my purpose. It's an apt passage to which to refer, actually, when we're looking at Daniel 6. Yahweh is there in Isaiah 46 making a general point. Yes, my purpose across the board will stand and nobody can change it. But he's also alluding to a particular purpose that he has. And that becomes clear in the next verse in Isaiah 46:11, where he continues, calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my counsel from a far country. What's he talking about? Who's this bird of prey, this man from the east that Yahweh is summoning? Well, it's King Cyrus. That's clear if you go back to kind of the beginning of this whole section, at the beginning of Isaiah 45, where Cyrus is mentioned by name. Cyrus is the king to whom Yahweh is referring in Isaiah 46:11. Now, almost certainly, Cyrus and Darius are the same person. And so if you go back to Daniel 6 and the last verse of our chapter, verse 28, Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, and the word "and" there is probably better translated, "that is." So during the reign of Darius, that is the reign of Cyrus the Persian. The history books don't know of a Darius. And we know from history, and we know from other parts of the Bible, like Isaiah, that the Persian emperor who defeated the Babylonians, the first Persian emperor, was Cyrus. And almost certainly then, Darius is another name for Cyrus that the writer of the book of Daniel was familiar with, and we're talking about the same man. So here we are then in Daniel 6, and we have this swaggering ruler there in verse 9 signing his law, thinking that he's passing this unalterable decree, and all the time Isaiah 46 is saying he himself is merely a component in the truly unalterable decree of a vastly greater ruler. What should our response to that be? Well, surely it should be to laugh at silly Darius, whose signature couldn't really guarantee anything, who couldn't really ensure that any of his laws remained unaltered. We should laugh at silly Darius and all other swaggering, silly rulers like him. And we should worship the one who really does accomplish all that he purposes. The one who is doing that tonight throughout this world. Everything that is taking place everywhere throughout this universe at this very moment is in fact simply conforming to the irresistible decree of the God of heaven. And so that's the first thing to notice in our passage tonight, the king's swaggering. But then secondly, notice with me the president's stand. The president's stand. And the president then to whom I'm referring is Daniel. We read in verse 2 that he was one of three presidents whom Darius had in his kingdom. And the stand to which I'm referring, the stand that President Daniel takes, well, you all know exactly what that is. It's the stand he takes in verse 10 in response, in the immediate aftermath to Darius's law. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open towards Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. We can't fail to be reminded here, can we, of chapter 3 of this book and the way that Daniel's friends, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, similarly took a stand in the face of Nebuchadnezzar's decree regarding the golden image. And I want to ask again now a question that I asked when we were considering that passage. And the question is this: what makes a man able to take a stand like this? What enables a man, or three men in chapter 3, to take a stand like this? How could he do it? And part of the answer that I'm going to give is the same as before in chapter 3, but we're able here in chapter 6 to add some further aspects. And so here are several reasons that Daniel is able to take this stand. First of all, because of a mentality. Because of a mentality. And what I mean is this: Daniel, remember, had cultivated a mentality from the very start of his time in this foreign land. We saw it in our very first sermon on Daniel back in chapter 1. And the way in which, remember, he initially in Babylon would only eat vegetables. And we said then that there was no absolute moral principle involved in that decision of Daniel's. He could have eaten meat without being guilty of sin. But it was simply Daniel's way of reminding himself at every evening mealtime, I'm different. I'm not one of them. I'm not going to blend in and become entirely like them, even in areas where I could legitimately do that. I'm going to keep some territory back from them, some territory where I'm distinctive. This, I said, was a revolutionary decision. It was a resistance act by Daniel. He could, legitimately before God, legitimately in conscience terms, have gone ahead and eaten meat. But he wanted, as I put it that night, to remain in battle mode. So that when later on bigger issues turned up, where moral principles were involved, he would be far readier to face them. And now in chapter 6, that's where we are. And here's Daniel then. And because he has cultivated that mentality from day one in Babylon, now he is in the best possible position to stand against this law and to keep on praying to Yahweh despite everything. And I ask us then, as I asked us a few weeks ago, are we cultivating that mentality? Are there regular components of our lives in which we are reminding ourselves, I'm different? That night I applied it to the Lord's Day. And I said that the Lord's Day itself and observance of the Lord's Day, it is, of course, a conscience issue, a moral issue. God has given us a commandment regarding the day. But I said that there are many details as to how we implement the Lord's Day, how we observe it, where we don't have commands and we don't have clarity. And there are things then, many things that we could do that are just the same as what everyone else is doing, and we could probably argue that I'm not sinning in doing those things. But making the day as distinctive as possible and setting it apart as much as we possibly can, that's Daniel-like. It's putting ourselves in resistance mode. It's saying, I'm not going to blend in with everyone else as far as I can on Sunday. Yes, I'll go to church, but the rest of the time I'll blend in as with everyone else. It's saying, I'm different. And I'm reminding myself every Sunday by giving the whole day a different colour to what everyone else gives it. I'm reminding myself that I am different. I belong to a different Lord. I'm living from a completely different place. I remember talking to Robert that Sunday evening, and he mentioned giving thanks before meals. And that's another good example, isn't it? Again, something we could say, well, there's no command that we have to do that. But something that reminds me every mealtime, as with Daniel, that I'm different. I belong to Yahweh. And so are we, in these different ways, cultivating that healthy mentality that will stand us in good stead when big issues come along, because it's just become ingrained in our thinking that I am under a different lordship. I belong to a different world. It's because of a mentality that Daniel can do this. But then secondly, it's because of a habit. It's because of a habit. Interesting, isn't it, how verse 10 ends? As he had done previously. I have a feeling that in our feelings-obsessed evangelical culture, habits generally get a bad press. And if Bible reading then, and prayer, and attendance at church gatherings, if they become habits, then it's assumed they kind of stifle vitality and they are the enemies of life. And they just develop necessarily into mindless rituals. Spontaneity is the great thing. That's the attitude, isn't it, that we often come across in our evangelical subculture, that spontaneity is good, habit, routine in devotional practices or whatever is a dubious thing. But there's another way of looking at habits, and it's this: habits can ingrain healthy activities like Bible reading and prayer and attendance at church gatherings. They can ingrain those healthy activities so deeply within us that nothing will root them out. Not even persecution, not even the threat of being thrown into the lion's den. That's Daniel's experience, isn't it? Praying three times a day in his upper room. That habit has made prayer so ingrained within him that it doesn't matter what decrees are coming out of the palace. He'll still pray. Doesn't make an ounce of difference. And if habits have the potential to do that, then I don't know about you, but I'm all in favour of them. Habits, we see in this experience of Daniel, are a great thing. They embed good, healthy activities at such a deep level of our beings that silly laws by foolish emperors like Darius cannot get at those healthy activities. So how can you take this stand? Because of a mentality, because of a habit. Thirdly, because of a relationship. What is prayer? Well, at the heart of prayer is nurturing a relationship with God, isn't it? Daniel wasn't merely bringing a list of petitions to God when he got down on his knees three times a day like this. No, he was becoming closer and closer to God in this way. He was becoming more and more intimately bound up with God in this way. And you know, that is the greatest thing that anybody can have. The greatest thing that anybody can have is an intimate, real relationship with the living God. There's nothing better than that. It is the very zenith of human experience. And when you have that, then, you don't crave after the best possible house that you can get your hands on. You don't crave after the best possible car you can get the keys for. You don't crave after the fanciest item of technology you can possibly possess. All these things have less of a hold on you when you are absorbed with God. That was David's experience. In fact, for David, even life itself that is mortal life in this world, even life itself was no longer this thing to be jealously prized above all else. God alone was to be jealously prized above all else. And so he could exclaim in Psalm 63 verse 3, "Your steadfast love is better than life." And I think Daniel here is on exactly the same wavelength as David. In the face of the lions, he doesn't jealously prize his survival on planet Earth above all else. No, he prefers communion with God. He would rather enjoy communion with God in his room and then be chucked into a lion's den than survive for many more years on this earth and be denied communion with God in his room. I wonder, do we know anything of that? You see, if prayer is just a duty, if it's just a command, if it's just a requirement, then it would be very hard, wouldn't it, to choose prayer ahead of escaping the lion's den. But if prayer is this means, if we know it in our personal experience as this means of enjoying the wonderful love of God and being immersed in this ocean of relational delights, then perhaps we would choose prayer over escaping the lion's den. So he can do this because of a mentality, because of a habit, because of a relationship. And then fourthly, because of a prospect. Because of a prospect. And here's where our answer to our question overlaps with our answer to the same question a few weeks ago in connection with chapter 3, because then I took you to Hebrews chapter 11 and drew your attention to the reference to Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego there, Hebrews 11 verse 34. The writer mentions those who quench the power of fire. And I said that's almost certainly a reference to those three friends of Daniel in Daniel chapter 3. But of course it's not just Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego who are mentioned in Hebrews 11. Many people are mentioned, and in the very preceding verse, verse 33 of Hebrews 11, those who stopped the mouths of lions. That's Daniel, obviously. And what did we say then that night as we were talking about Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego? What have we said many times over the years when we've come to Hebrews 11? We've said that all the people mentioned were driven by faith, that's obvious. But we said more than that, the faith that drives the people mentioned in Hebrews 11 isn't simply saving faith. That's not really the type of faith the writer is focusing on. What is faith in Hebrews 11? It's not so much that faith that Paul talks about in Romans and Ephesians and Galatians, that helpless dependence upon the finished work of Christ. That, of course, is absolutely vital. But this is another strand of faith. Faith in Hebrews 11 is what? It is looking forward, looking ahead to the world to come, the heavenly country, as the writer calls it. It's seeing that presently invisible future of ours, and it's carrying on step by step toward that inheritance that God has promised to us. And so we're being told then in Hebrews 11:33 that this was true of Daniel as well as Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. That Daniel was a man who lived for the future, who lived for the world to come. It's interesting, isn't it? The detail here in our passage that he had this open window towards Jerusalem. And you read that and you think, poor old Daniel. Doesn't he know what's happened to Jerusalem? There he is thinking all sentimentally about Jerusalem. Jerusalem's a heap of ruins. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. Jerusalem's no more. And there he is thinking that he's doing something significant by praying toward Jerusalem. Now Daniel knew very well what had happened to Jerusalem. He knew it was a heap of smouldering ruins. But Daniel knew too that Jerusalem, the literal city there in Judah, that it had a deeper significance, that it symbolized and pointed forward to another city, the city talked about in Hebrews 11, the city with foundations whose builder and architect is God. Daniel knew that Jerusalem pointed to the eternal city, the world to come, which wasn't lying in smouldering ruins, but which still was a certain prospect for him. And that's why he opened the window toward Jerusalem. He wasn't being superstitious. He wasn't being nostalgic and sentimental. He was expressing his forward-looking faith in the city that is to come. And because then he had this faith in a future inheritance, he wasn't scared of what the lions might do to him. Because he knew that the lions couldn't take that from him. They could take his life, they could rip his skin to pieces, but they couldn't take that from him. Darius, with his stupid law, couldn't take that from him. It's again another level of irony, actually, isn't it? That there we have Darius in verse 14 that I've already mentioned, and he's kind of all agitated and distressed because he's so powerless to restore something to Daniel, namely Daniel's freedom. In actual fact, the real situation is that Darius was powerless to take anything from Daniel in the first place. He couldn't really take anything from Daniel that was truly significant to Daniel. Because what was truly significant to Daniel was this world to come. And Darius's law couldn't take that. And again then, the more we are living for that world to come, the less we will be scared of what our enemies can take from us. Because whatever they can take from us, it's far less than that that cannot be taken from us. That's like Daniel. In our more privileged position of knowing far more about the world to come. Although he knew a fair bit, and we'll talk later in this book of the resurrection of the dead, those being wakened from the dust of the ground. But we know even more because we've seen the first raised man on Easter Sunday morning. Let us, like Daniel, be those who live for the heavenly country. So we've seen then this evening the king's swagger, and we've seen the president stand, Daniel able to stand in the face of this law for all these reasons. But then just thirdly and finally, the Jews' salvation. The Jews' salvation. Last time then I talked about Daniel as a picture of Christ, an Old Testament picture of Christ in his rise from being discarded by King Belshazzar to then becoming this top man in the kingdom. And I said that rise, in some way, it points to the rise of the ultimate discarded man, the one crucified by the rulers of this age. And we have then another rise here, don't we? Daniel again is in another pickle. Again, he's a discarded man, this time discarded in a lion's den, thrown in there, spends a night in there, and then out he comes and rises to a position of prosperity, as the final verse of our chapter indicates. And in fact, in this rise of Daniel, we see even more points of contact, don't we, with the rise of Jesus. And there are really too many to properly focus on, but there are so many similarities in the two stories. The way that Daniel's predicament comes about through false witnesses, just as Jesus will be convicted on the basis of false witnesses. The way in which Daniel is thrown into the lion's den despite the efforts of a reluctant ruler, and Jesus will be nailed to a cross despite the efforts of a reluctant ruler, Pilate. The way in which then Daniel in the lion's den has that stone placed over the pit, and Jesus will be placed in a tomb and a stone placed over the entrance. The way in which Darius runs to the pit at the break of day and encounters the living Daniel, so similar to the way in which those women flee to the pit, the cave, on Easter Sunday morning and encounter the living Jesus. And so there are all these parallels. Daniel, again, this pointer to Christ. But there's something else in connection with that here in our passage. I think we often read Daniel 6 and overlook the wider implications of this law, and we think merely about what it meant for Daniel, the consequences of this law for Daniel. But of course, the law isn't if Daniel prays to anyone except Darius, he will be thrown into the lion's den. The law is that anyone who does this will be thrown into the lion's den. Now remember, there are thousands of Jews there in Persia as well as Daniel. And they would all have felt the impact of this law. And they too then, if they carried on praying to their God Yahweh, as they must if they are faithful, they too would have to be thrown into the lion's den. Which means then that what we have here in Daniel 6, at the end of the day, is an act of deliverance by substitution, isn't it? One Jew goes into the lion's den. Daniel goes in there. And Daniel goes in there. And he spends that night in there. And then he comes out of there. And then what happens? Verse 25. Peace is proclaimed to all the peoples of the kingdom, including the Jews. Probably especially the Jews. That's probably really the intention of this. That Darius is sending. Why does he need to say peace be multiplied to you? Most of the people in his kingdom couldn't care tuppence about this law. It's the Jews probably that he has in mind. They're the ones who have been distressed by it, because they're the ones who must keep on praying to Yahweh. Peace, he says. It's all right now. You have peace. Daniel goes into the lion's den on behalf of all the Jews, and he comes out, and peace is proclaimed to the Jewish nation. And what a lovely pointer then to Jesus, who alone goes to the cross. The lion's den. We sang in Psalm 22, Jesus talking about the lion's mouths roaring. It's not quite clear what he means by that. Perhaps he's talking about the human figures around the cross. But interesting, he uses that language of the lions. Jesus goes into the lion's den of Calvary. And he doesn't have a nice night there like Daniel did. He suffers. He's tormented, as we saw this morning. But then he's buried and he comes out. And his first words are peace, shalom. And he goes into the upper room, peace, shalom, peace be multiplied to you. And you all know this, but we can't be reminded too often, can we? That we tonight then, if we are believers in Jesus, we have peace. Because our Daniel, our Jesus, went into the lion's den for us. And he took the savagery of the cross that we might have peace. Are you reveling in that peace tonight? Peace not with Darius, peace with God. Peace with the Almighty, peace with your Maker. Don't let anyone disturb or disrupt it. Don't let your conscience do so. Don't let the evil one do so. Know tonight, as you put your head on your pillow, if I'm trusting in Christ, the one who went into the lion's den for me, I have peace. And live boldly this week out of that position of peace. And if you don't have peace tonight, come to Jesus. Amen.